For 42 minutes the crowd followed her lead. Regardless of whether, as some speculated, this lady had been cued to begin blowing kisses and rallying support for the colonel, the emotional Roosevelt demonstration ended the prospect of bringing Hadley to the stage as a compromise candidate. When Root finally restored order, Hadley stood up, returning the convention's focus to the delegate confirmation process for the contested seats. While both he and Root agreed that no man can be permitted to vote upon the question of his own right to a seat in the convention, Hadley stridently argued that the entire group of contested delegates should be barred from determining the composition of the vital credentials committee. Root, however, adhering to congressional parliamentary procedure, maintained that the rule does not disqualify any delegates whose name is on the roll from voting upon the contest of any other man's right, or participating in the ordinary business of the convention so long as he holds his seat. This pivotal ruling, which allowed all the contested delegates to participate in the makeup of the Credentials Committee, essentially delivered control of the convention to Taft. The committee members began their deliberations that night. Outnumbered 31-21, the Roosevelt men soon realized that the Taft contingency had no intention of relitigating the National Committee's seating decisions. It was evident that most, if not all, of the contested delegates from the temporary roll would retain their seats, thereby providing Taft a clear majority. At midnight, a message arrived from the colonel himself. "We are requested to go at once to the Florentine room of the Congress Hotel," California's Francis Heaney shouted, dismissively observing, "We can't get a square deal here." Back at the hotel, rebellious delegates and regular party members debated whether to bolt. While talk of a new party had been in the air since the convention opened, they now faced the difficult reality of engineering a split and financing a new creation. Suddenly, the prospect of leaving party lines, even to support Colonel Roosevelt, did not seem half as attractive as from some miles further away. If the prospective members were to be anything other than ridiculous figures in their state campaigns, this new party would require time and money and effort, with money the paramount resource. Amos Pinchot would long recall the moment when the third party was born. At 2 o'clock in the morning, Roosevelt's inner circle gathered in his bedroom suite. A dozen were seated around the table, the rest in armchairs or leaning against the wall, Pinchot wrote. Roosevelt was walking rapidly up and down in silence. All eyes were on Frank Muncy and George Perkins, who whispered together in the corner. Without the financial support of these two wealthy men, there was little hope that a new party could be organized in time for the fall election. Suddenly, the whispered talk ceased, Pinchot recollected, as both Muncy and Perkins moved over to Roosevelt, meeting him in the middle of the room. Each placed a hand on one of his shoulders, and one or both of them said, "Colonel, we will see you through." Muncy, the more effusive of the two magnates, added, "My fortune, my magazines, and my newspapers are with you." Returning to the conference room, Roosevelt read a short announcement to his delegates and supporters. If the convention refused to purge the tainted roll, the colonel had resolved to lead a fight for his principles in defiance of any action of the regular Republican convention. He expressed his thanks to those who had come thus far in his fight, but who might not care to continue with him further. He would release these men, parting from them on terms of friendship and undiminished gratitude. Those who chose to stay, he invited to participate in the birth of a new party. "Grizzled veterans wiped tears from their eyes," observed a reporter for the Washington Times, making no effort to conceal their emotions. As word spread that Roosevelt might come in person to deliver a statement that next day, the convention hall was jammed to its fullest capacity. Minutes after Root gaveled the convention to order, Taft's floor leader called for a recess, explaining that the report of the Credentials Committee was not ready. A later 4 o'clock session lasted only a minute because the committee was still not ready. After this second delay, the convention was adjourned until the following day. Leaving the hall, delegates and spectators gathered in knots, trying to piece together what was happening. Word circulated that men on both sides had revived the search for a compromise candidate. Perhaps Cummins, or Hughes, or Hadley. It was rumored, but later denied, that Taft had agreed to withdraw his candidacy, providing Colonel Roosevelt would do the same. Details of the dramatic midnight session in Roosevelt's suite gradually began to surface. Foremost, Roosevelt's pledge to continue fighting if the Credentials Committee refused to seat his honestly elected delegates. The mayhem in Chicago attracted unprecedented attention in the press. Correspondents covered every reversal, every sensational, rancorous moment with relish. Reporters from dozens of national and regional publications were busy politicking, filing correspondence, intriguing, pretending they were making a president. Sam McClure, who had come to the convention on his own, stood on the edges of the clusters of journalists, feeling like a cipher. He had been shorn as editor of his once celebrated magazine a month earlier, when his accumulated debt had finally forced him to lease and then sell McClure's. The buyer had originally promised to retain McClure as editor, but the final deal left SS, in his own words, unhorsed. He had come to Chicago in search of work. At the convention hall and in the lobbies of the hotels, the 55-year-old McClure met up with scores of old friends. For the first time in his life, observing the hurly-burly of the convention, Sam McClure found himself on the periphery of the action. At noon on Friday, June 21st, after two straight nights with little sleep, the Credentials Committee was finally ready to issue state-by-state reports on the contested seats. Proceeding alphabetically with Alabama, the committee chairman announced that the majority had voted to sustain the original decision of the National Committee and seat the two Taft delegates. A minority report introduced by the Roosevelt members was immediately voted down by a safe Taft majority. A storm of hisses and booing broke out, but Root swiftly restored order, calling on Arizona and then Arkansas. As one state after another voted to seat the Taft delegates, a voice from the gallery rose from the din, "Roll the steamroller some more!" As each new case was decided in favor of Taft's delegates, 1,000 toots and imitation whistles of the steamroller engine pierced the air. Bedlam followed as the galleries caught the spirit, rhythmically shouting, "Toot, toot, and choo-choo!" The police removed a man who interrupted the proceedings by repeatedly crying, "All aboard!" As he was escorted out, he grinned and waved, provoking a great uproar. The convention was adjourned until the following day, when, amid a chorus of shrieks, whistles, groans, and catcalls, the remainder of the states followed suit, granting Taft all 72 contested delegates. With Taft's nomination on the first ballot virtually guaranteed, Henry Allen, a Roosevelt delegate from Kansas, asked to read a statement from the colonel. "The convention has now declined to purge the roll of the fraudulent delegates," Roosevelt's announcement began. "This action makes the convention in no proper sense any longer a Republican convention representing the real Republican Party. Therefore, I hope that the men elected as Roosevelt delegates will now decline to vote on any matter before the convention. Any man nominated by the convention as now constituted would be merely the beneficiary of this successful fraud." Roosevelt's inflammatory words provoked near riot on the convention floor. Taft delegates physically attacked Roosevelt delegates. Brawls erupted throughout the galleries. Although police stopped dozens of scuffles, they were unable to keep track of them all. It was nearly 7:30 p.m. on Saturday night before the roll call for the nomination began. At 9:28 p.m., William Howard Taft was officially proclaimed the victor, with 561 votes. 344 Roosevelt delegates had followed the colonel's request, designating themselves present but not voting. An additional 107 delegates insisted on following the command of their primaries, casting their votes for Roosevelt. Of the remaining votes, La Follette received 41, Senator Cummins 17, and Justice Hughes, 2. The White House was so quiet on the night the convention concluded, one reporter remarked, that no one would have suspected that under the same roof was the man who had been named as candidate of the ruling party. During the balloting, Taft had been with Nellie and their children in the living quarters. Young Charlie Taft was once again in charge of carrying the up-to-date bulletins from the telegraph office. Reporters noted that the 12-year-old was all grin when word came that his father had secured a majority vote for the nomination. But unlike the electric excitement that had filled the room 4 years earlier, when Nellie had sparkled with happiness and Taft had laughed with the joy of a boy, both the President and First Lady clearly understood that the divisive convention had rendered Republican chances for election in November almost impossible. "No Republican convention ever adjourned," observed the New York Tribune, "leaving so many sores and with so little prospect that the wounds would be healed." "I am not afraid of defeat in November," Taft repeatedly said in the days that followed his nomination. He believed he had already achieved the victory he wanted by preventing Roosevelt from taking over the Republican Party and moving it in an incomprehensibly radical direction that threatened to upset the constitutional separation of powers and destroy the absolute independence of the judiciary. In the course of the campaign, he had come to regard Roosevelt as a real menace to our institutions. "The central issue at stake," he declared, in his first public statement after his nomination, "was whether the Republican Party would remain the chief conservator of the country's constitutional guarantees." His victory, he proudly noted, had preserved the party organization as a nucleus for conservative action. The Roosevelt delegates had begun their exodus from the Coliseum even before the finalization of Taft's nomination. A mass meeting had been called at Orchestra Hall, a short distance away, to begin the process of forming a new national party. Great applause greeted Edith and the Roosevelt children as they took their seats in a box near the platform. News that conservative Vice President James Sherman had been renominated added to the delight of the Roosevelt men, who had worried that Taft might try to bolster the Republican ticket by selecting a progressive for the second spot. As they waited for the various state delegations to arrive from the convention, the audience joined in a spirited rendition of America. When the California delegation paraded into the hall bearing its distinctive Golden Bear banner, the crowd erupted with wild enthusiasm. A new round of cheers began a few minutes later when the Ohio delegation entered the room. "Here comes Texas," screamed a man in the audience as the Lone Star delegation marched in, followed in short order by Oklahoma. Similar waves of cheering met each of the delegations as they entered the room, creating a jubilant atmosphere. California Governor Hiram Johnson opened the formal proceedings of the new Progressive Party. "We came here," he declared, "to carry out the mandate of the people to nominate Theodore Roosevelt. By a fraud, he has been robbed of that which was his. We, the delegates, free and untrammeled, have come here to nominate him tonight." After a nominating resolution was unanimously passed, a notification committee composed of representatives from 22 states escorted Roosevelt into the hall. The people leaped to their feet with a shout, and for 5 minutes there was pandemonium, the New York Tribune reported. Another demonstration ensued when Roosevelt mounted the stage to declare his acceptance. He charged supporters to go home, find out the sentiment of the people, and then reconvene a few weeks later at a mass convention to nominate a progressive candidate on a progressive platform that would truly represent people in all sections of the country. "If you wish me to make the fight, I will make it," he promised, "even if only one state should support me. The only condition I impose is that you shall be free when you come together to substitute any other man in my place if you deem it better for the movement, and in such case I will give him my heartiest support." The enthusiasm that had sustained the Roosevelt progressives all week reached a peak that evening at Orchestra Hall. That a split party had little prospect for victory in November seemed irrelevant to the exuberant crowd, though not to former Republican Senator Chauncey Depew, who offered a widely quoted comment as the 1912 Republican National Convention came to a close. "The only question now," he said, "is which corpse gets the most flowers." During the last week of June, as Democrats gathered in Baltimore to choose their nominee for president, reporters asked Roosevelt for his thoughts on the leading contenders, Speaker Champ Clark and New Jersey Governor Woodrow Wilson. "I'm in the fight for an independent Republican Party," Roosevelt defiantly declared, "and whatever the Democrats do will make no difference with me." Bluster aside, Roosevelt knew he had a much greater chance of victory if the Democrats chose the more conservative Clark over Wilson, who had emerged as a progressive champion. "Pop's been praying for Clark," Kermit Roosevelt disclosed, revealing a Roosevelt far from indifferent to the outcome. Like the Republicans, the Democrats quickly evidenced party discord in their own battle to appoint the temporary chair. Clark, with the backing of Tammany Hall, won that first skirmish, but progressives refused to accept his nominee, overturning the result when the time came to choose a permanent chair. "Everybody's doing it. Doesn't it remind you of Chicago?" Roosevelt gleefully asked reporters. When the balloting began for the nomination, Clark took an early lead, reaching a majority vote on the 10th ballot. Democratic Party rules required a two-thirds vote for victory, however. By the 14th ballot, the momentum had shifted to Wilson. 16 ballots later, Wilson held a slight majority. But it was not until the 46th ballot, 8 turbulent days after the Democratic National Convention opened, that the New Jersey governor finally secured the nomination. The suspenseful events in Baltimore had transfixed the nation's attention. All week long, William White reported, the country was standing around the billboards of newspapers in great crowds, waiting for the latest news from that city. Throughout the dramatic ordeal, Wilson appeared impassive. "You must sometimes have wondered why I did not show more emotions as the news came in from the convention," he told reporters when word of his victory finally arrived, "and I have been afraid that you might get the impression that I was so self-confident and sure of the result that I took the steady increase in the vote for me complacently and as a matter of course. The fact is that the emotion has been too deep to come to the surface." Wilson's nomination immediately affected Roosevelt's campaign prospects. Chase Osborne, one of the 7 governors who had originally urged the colonel to run, announced that he intended to support New Jersey's Democratic governor. With a progressive in the field, he explained, there was no necessity for a new political party. The president of Minnesota's Progressive League agreed with Osborne, declaring that his organization would back Wilson. To illustrate that Wilson's appeal crossed party lines, his campaign cited more than 2,000 letters from Republicans pledging support. "Warmest congratulations from a Roosevelt progressive Republican who will vote for Wilson," one Californian had written. "I most gladly leave my old party, the party of my father, and join your cause," declared a lawyer from West Virginia. Robert La Follette was delighted to support Woodrow Wilson. Still consumed with anger toward Roosevelt for projecting his personal ambition for a third term onto a strong and rapidly growing progressive movement within the Republican Party, La Follette insisted that he would devote his days to exposing the Roosevelt fraud. Calling the colonel's primary battle the most extravagant in American history, La Follette vowed to travel through the West, convincing farmers and laborers alike that men notoriously identified with the Steel Trust and the Harvester Trust were among Roosevelt's chief financial backers. Wilson gratefully acknowledged La Follette's support, lauding the Wisconsin senator as a courageous leader. Taunted, laughed at, called back, going steadfastly on. If Wilson had been nominated first, Roosevelt privately conceded, he might never have initiated the movement for a third party. But it was quite out of the question, he told a friend, after having led my men into the fight, that I should then abandon them. Now supporters would conclude that he was flinching from the contest, that he was not game enough to stand punishment and face the possibility of disaster. Moreover, Roosevelt contended, while Wilson might be an excellent man, supporting him would mean restoring to power the Democratic bosses in Congress and in several states, and I don't think that we can excuse ourselves for such action. The die was cast. On July 7th, Roosevelt's campaign manager, Senator Dixon, released a call to the people of the United States designating August 5th for a convention in Chicago of the newly formed National Progressive Party. Each state was asked to send a block of delegates equal to the total of its senators and representatives, selected by whatever method the state leaders desired. The call urged all those in all sections of the country who believed in a national progressive movement to rally together to secure the better and more equitable diffusion of prosperity and to strike at the roots of privilege in both industry and politics. 63 prominent Republicans in 40 states signed the declaration. But to Roosevelt's chagrin, many of his once most fervent supporters held back. Those who were running for office faced a difficult choice: forsake their hero or join an untested party with little time to develop the machinery to get out the vote. In the end, Montana Senator Joseph Dixon was the only senator or governor up for re-election who took the leap of joining the Progressive Party. Senators Cummins, Hadley, Borah, and Nelson declared their opposition to Taft, but declined to desert the Republican Party, promising instead to reform it from within. These defections both saddened and irritated Roosevelt, who believed the national cause should hold precedence. "I feel that Cummins naturally belongs to us," he lamented to one friend, while confessing to another, "I greatly regret that Hadley was so foolish as not to come with us." Carefully observing Roosevelt's efforts to establish his Bull Moose Party, the name the newspapers gave to the new organization, Taft felt the colonel's campaign was sagging. With a trace of sympathy, he remarked to Nellie that the colonel was up against now what I have always had to contend against, to wit, the selfishness of local candidates. And he is feeling the effects, I suppose, of a tendency to regularity that a third party always has to fight. Nonetheless, Taft predicted, Roosevelt was such a persistent talker that he would compel the courage of his followers. Though he believed Roosevelt utterly unscrupulous at times, Taft marveled at his method of stating things and his power of attracting public attention. Despite the historic dominance of the two-party system, the colonel remained confident that once the object and purposes of his campaign were made clear, many voters would be won over, in particular, those holding back for a nicer definition of his aims. During the final 2 weeks in July, Roosevelt canceled public appearances and refused visitors, closeting himself hour after hour in his private study at Sagamore Hill to prepare both the planks of the new party's platform and the keynote address he would deliver on August 5th, the first day of the convention. Fully aware that a great measure of his party's success would depend upon the strength and solidity of its principles and platform, he promised that his speech would represent the greatest effort of his life. When he finished the first draft of the platform, Roosevelt took a single day off, amusing reporters with his characteristically frenetic style of relaxation. Got up with the sun, worked in the library until breakfast, took Mrs. Roosevelt for a long walk toward Cold Spring Harbor, rode about 12 miles, went horseback riding after luncheon, and played 6 sets of tennis on his return. The next morning he was back at his desk, reinvigorated, to complete his projected 15,000-word keynote speech on schedule. In the wake of the contentious Republican National Convention, President Taft wisely decided that simplicity should be the distinguishing feature of his notification ceremony, scheduled for August 1st. There would be none of the fireworks, open-air concerts, booming cannons, parades, or decorated streets that had made Cincinnati so festive 4 years earlier. Marked by unusual informality, the ceremony would be held in the White House, with only 400 persons in attendance, primarily cabinet officials, members of Congress, and prominent Republican figures. During the last week in July, Taft worked an average of 16 hours a day on his acceptance speech, designed as a defense of the Republican Party, the Constitution, judicial independence, private property, and civil liberty. Roosevelt proposes to give out a radical platform that will startle some people, he told his Aunt Delia, recognizing exactly where he stood in the current political landscape. Wilson says that his letter of acceptance is going to be radical. So, between the two, I have no part to play but that of a conservative, and that I am going to play. The notification ceremony took place at noon in the East Room. The seats had been positioned in a semicircle around a raised platform. Stationed in the adjoining hallway, the Marine Band played patriotic airs. Warm applause greeted Nellie as she walked in and took her seat on the dais. Shortly thereafter, President Taft, accompanied by members of the Notification Committee, entered amid loud shouts and hand-clapping. Following tradition, the chair of the Notification Committee, Elihu Root, delivered the official news of Taft's nomination. In his brief remarks, Root referred to the turmoil surrounding the contested delegates. Speaking with force and authority, Root assured the president that as the convention's presiding officer, he had followed long-established and unquestioned rules of law governing the party at every step along the way. "Your title to the nomination is as clear and unimpeachable as the title of any candidate of any party since political conventions began." Root's testimonial provided tremendous comfort to Taft, who worried that Roosevelt's continued harping on the seating of delegates had persuaded people that his campaign had committed great frauds and that he had, in effect, stolen the nomination. Taft accepted the nomination on behalf of a Republican Party through which substantially all the progress and development in our country's history in the last 50 years has been finally effected. "Our party," he declared, "stands for the right of property and the right of liberty, for institutions that have stood the test of time, and for an economic system that rewards energy, courage, enterprise, attention to duty, hard work, thrift, and providence, rather than laziness, lack of attention, lack of industry, the yielding to appetite and passion." While he hoisted the conservative banner, Taft also spoke with genuine pride of the progressive legislation passed in recent years. The railroad legislation, the postal banking system, workers' compensation, an 8-hour day for all government contracts, and, most recently, the Children's Bureau, the first federal agency dedicated to the social welfare of children. Even as the Republican Party protected the traditions of the past, he argued, it must remain sensitive to the shifting views of the role of government. "Time was," he explained, "when the least government was thought the best, and the policy which left all to the individual, unmolested and unaided by the government, was deemed the wisest. As industry consolidation and wealth disparity grew apace, however, it was clearly recognized that the government had a responsibility to further equality of opportunity in respect of the weaker classes in their dealings with the stronger and more powerful." In sum, Taft did not intend to take the country backward, but rather to protect it against the demagogic proposals of his adversaries. Asked to comment on Taft's speech, Roosevelt initially told reporters he preferred to answer the president in his own upcoming address at the Progressive Party convention. On second thought, he proved unable to restrain himself, derogating Taft's words as fatuous, inadequate, conservative, and ignorant of all the live issues. Chapter 29. Armageddon. As members of the Progressive Party began filling Chicago's hotels in preparation for the August 5th opening of the Bull Moose Convention, journalists remarked that no man could go through the lobbies without confronting a gathering of people that looked less like the average Republican or Democratic convention than anything you ever saw. There was not a saloon keeper in the crowd. The delegates were younger and more earnest than the usual convention goers. Petticoats were everywhere. Hundreds of social workers, suffragettes, and advocates for working girls' rights had enlisted in the new party. Instead of forcing your way through a crowd of tobacco-stained political veterans, the New York Times observed, you raise your hat politely and say, "Pardon me, madam." A sense of great adventure was in the air, William Allen White observed, despite the certainty of a convention seemingly without contest or climax, a convention apparently devoid of chance or speculation. No one questioned who the nominee would be or how it would come about. There would be no dead places in the convention hall, no blocks of delegates seated with arms folded, with faces set and sullen, while other delegates behaved like dancing dervishes. There was little dissent on any major issue. Almost everyone believed in the social gospel. They had come to Chicago as crusaders, satisfied that they were in the right. Roosevelt had already contrived his response to the only issue that threatened this near-perfect accord. Though the new party embraced a number of Negro delegates from the North, more, in fact, Roosevelt noted, than ever before figured in a national convention, there would not be a single Negro delegate from the South. The colonel had given Southern progressives permission to send solely white state delegations. Hoping to break into the solid South, he had persuaded himself that true justice would only come to Negro residents of old Confederate states by enlisting the efforts of high-minded white men. Roosevelt's policy was riddled with contradictions and paradoxes, historian John Gable succinctly observes. He wanted to establish the new nationalism on a nationwide basis by using a sectionalist approach. He sought to bring an end to racism by a racist strategy. When word of Roosevelt's lily-white delegations leaked, discord surfaced among party members attending the convention. Once Roosevelt made it clear that he absolutely would not budge, the issue quickly faded from discussion. It was evident to all that Roosevelt himself was the whole show, the rhyme and reason for the new party. Once again, Chicago went mad with Theodore Roosevelt's arrival. The streets were blocked, all work came to a halt, and the sidewalks were filled with thousands of people. Standing in the rear of an open automobile as he made his way to the same hotel suite where he had stayed during the Republican convention, Roosevelt was buoyant. "My friends," he proclaimed, "it is a great pleasure for me to be in Chicago again, and this time at the birth of a new party, and not at the death of an old party." Reaching the Congress Hotel, he settled in to work on his all-important speech. He had deliberately scheduled his address before the platform was voted on, informing delegates that he would accept their nomination only if the party's agenda corresponded to the views he intended to outline in his Confession of Faith. When Roosevelt stepped onto the stage of the Coliseum, he received perhaps one of the greatest personal demonstrations that has ever been given a man in public life. Seasoned reporters were long accustomed to staged political rallies. Over the years, they had witnessed hundreds of men marching about with signs and banners and shouting themselves hoarse, but this display of genuine emotion was unprecedented. The men and women gathering in Chicago had left past affiliations behind, having decided to cast their lots together under the banner of a fledgling movement. They signaled their collective identity with a unique battle flag, a red bandana chosen to represent the Plain People, the heart of the country. Every man wore the party's emblem around his neck. Every woman had one around her wrist. One delegate had even fastened a red bandana around the neck of a stuffed bull moose strategically placed at the front of the auditorium. Roosevelt stood smiling in the center of the storm, waving his bandana at friends in various delegations. 20,000 voices spontaneously rose in the battle hymn of the Republic, the assembled crusaders finding courage and unity in the stirring words and soaring melody. During the nearly hour-long demonstration, Roosevelt's managers invited a procession of people onto the platform to shake hands with the colonel. When Jane Addams was led to the stage, the delegates sprang to their feet and yelled, offering a moving tribute to the settlement house worker who had committed her life to helping the poor and the underprivileged. "I have been fighting for progressive principles for 30 years, she said. "This is the first time there has been a chance to make them effective. This is the biggest day of my life." When it seemed that the ecstatic tumult would never end, Roosevelt looked toward his wife, seated in a box near the stage. While Edith had dreaded her husband's entry into the race, she knew that once he had committed himself to the fight, he had to carry it through. Noting a jovial smile and bright eye on Edith's face, Roosevelt beamed. He took off his hat and hailed her, inspiring the delegates to follow suit. Then, en masse, they gave homage to the former First Lady, doffing their hats and cheering with abandon. Mrs. Roosevelt shrank into her chair, Richard Harding Davis reported. Her confusion, her pleasure, her distress were as pretty as was the compliment the men strove to pay her. Before their onslaught of goodwill and admiration, she blushed and looked like a young girl. Cheering continued unabated until she rose from her seat and bowed to the crowd. "That curtsy she made," exclaimed a correspondent who had covered the Roosevelt family since their days in Albany, "was the most prominent part I ever saw Mrs. Roosevelt take in public life." At last, the crowd composed itself enough for Roosevelt to speak. "At present," he began, "both the old parties are controlled by professional politicians in the interests of the privileged classes. Together, they would forge a new progressive party based on the right of the people to rule." Though the delegates cheered the familiar litany of progressive proposals to establish popular sovereignty through presidential primaries, direct election of senators, and the publication of campaign contributions, they reserved their most sustained applause for the colonel's pledge to secure women the right to the vote. "In most cases where men applaud the mention of women's suffrage, they do it with a grin," one reporter remarked. "But at this convention, old men and young men alike got up on their chairs, yelled like wild Indians, and waved anything available and portable." Each new reform that Roosevelt projected, the New York Times noted, even the most radical, fell on willing ears. The call for a living wage, the prohibition of child labor, federal regulation of interstate corporations, a graduated inheritance tax, an 8-hour workday for women, new standards for workmen's compensation, and finally, a system of social insurance designed to protect citizens against the hazards of sickness, irregular employment, and old age, to which both employers and employees would both contribute. "Surely, there never was a fight better worth making than the one in which we are engaged," Roosevelt proclaimed. "Whatever fate may at the moment overtake any of us, the movement itself will not stop." He closed his 2-hour address with the same stirring lines he had uttered 7 weeks earlier in Chicago. "We stand at Armageddon, and we battle for the Lord." The following day, the platform, a purely Rooseveltian document, embracing everything the colonel wanted, was approved. Nominations followed for the presidency. Jane Addams was among those who seconded Roosevelt's nomination, marking the first time a woman ever had made a seconding speech in a national convention of a big party. After Roosevelt's unanimous election, the delegates chose California Governor Hiram Johnson as the vice presidential nominee. When the two men entered the hall, wave upon wave of emotion swept over the audience. When Roosevelt, equally moved, began to speak, his voice trembled, and he seemed to forget all the little tricks he commonly deployed when trying to reach an audience. He simply thanked the delegates from the bottom of his heart, saying, "I have been president, and I measure my words when I say I hold it by far the greatest honor and the greatest opportunity that has ever come to me, to be called by you to the leadership for the time being of this great movement." "The Bull Moose Party has attained more strength and following than I thought possible at first," Ray Baker recorded in his journal not long after Roosevelt's powerfully emotional speech. "It includes no small number of high, idealistic, sincere men. Its platform is excellent. I can accept the planks nearly every one. A great figure in it is Miss Addams. It has aroused in some quarters almost a fanatical interest." Despite, or perhaps because of, his allegiance to the new party's principles, Baker could not shake a sense of disenchantment with its presidential nominee. "It is odd to me, as though the scales had suddenly fallen from my eyes," he reflected, "to see how different I regard T.R. from what I did a few years ago. There was no more enthusiastic and earnest admirer of him than I was. I felt that he was doing a great work, as I still believe he did do, the work of a great moral revivalist. But at this juncture, Baker believed, the progressive movement needed a steadier hand, a leader great enough to forget himself in service of the cause. Roosevelt's titanic persona, the reporter lamented, obscures everything, reducing the campaign to a referendum on his personal popularity, rather than a discussion of vital reform issues. In the end, Baker's concern over Roosevelt's distracting cult of personality was strong enough to shift his political allegiance. "As for me," Baker declared that August, "I shall vote for Wilson. I distrust the old party behind him and some of the things it stands for, but I have great confidence in the man and in the faction of the party, the progressive Bryan faction, which he represents. And I like his clear, calm way of putting things." Baker had first encountered Wilson 2 years earlier as he prepared an article on the forerunners of the 1912 campaign. "I left Princeton," Baker recalled years later, "convinced that I had met the finest mind in the field of statesmanship to be found in American public life." After that striking first impression, Baker followed Wilson's meteoric career with great interest. Overjoyed by Wilson's subsequent nomination for the presidency, Baker even dared to make speeches on the Democratic nominee's behalf. William Allen White had initially shared Baker's concerns, believing that the Progressive Party would be diminished if conceived as a personal party. He had advised Roosevelt against bolting from the Republicans, preferring that he remain an ace for the future, when the new party had developed more fully. On a personal level, White found Wilson a cold fish, with a heighty-tighty way. The hand Wilson extended when the two men first met felt like a 10-cent pickled mackerel in brown paper, irresponsive and lifeless. Nevertheless, White recognized that Wilson had done a fine liberal job as governor and would most likely make a good president. Covering the Democratic convention for a string of newspapers, White had cheered when Wilson defeated Clark. Once Roosevelt mortgaged his own future to the new party, however, White never looked back. He quit his post as Republican National Committee man, joined the Progressive Party, and resolved to do everything possible for his hero and the progressive cause. Playing a central role on the platform committee, White spent 4 days and the better part of 3 nights at the Congress Hotel the week prior to the convention, drafting and reworking every section of the document before the delegates arrived. "Our social philosophy," he proudly remarked, "could be simmered down to a single phrase, using government as an agency of human welfare." Witnessing Roosevelt during the heady days of the Bull Moose Convention, White was impressed anew with his old friend's remarkable vitality. He seemed full of animal spirits, exhaustless at all hours, exuding cheer and confidence, the journalist observed. The rage that had consumed him during the Republican National Convention seemed transformed into ebullience with the birth of the new party. What if he was a little obvious now and then as he grabbed the steering wheel of events and guided that convention not too shyly? White later reflected, explaining, "I felt the joy and delight of his presence, and knowing his weakness still gave him my loyalty. The great, rumbling, roaring, jocund tornado of a man." While White was transfixed by Roosevelt's performance during the Bull Moose Convention, his colleague Ida Tarbell was restlessly stuck in Paris. "It makes me crazy to get back," she wrote to Bert Boyden. "Of course, TR is a wonder, but what about those Negro delegates? It looks to us here like a suicidal operation. But, of course, nothing he does counts." Though Tarbell had long been ambivalent about Roosevelt, she believed the financial and industrial powers arrayed against him were 1,000 times more dangerous than he. Months earlier, she had written to John Phillips, suggesting that the magazine ought to address the widespread fear-mongering that equated Roosevelt's pursuit of a third term with a slide into absolute monarchy. "Why stop a third term?" opponents repeatedly warned. "The same reasons will apply for a fourth term, or for any number of terms." Without term limits, they argued, Roosevelt would simply stay in power for life. "We've got a king now," Tarbell parried. "This Wall Street, petty boss, Tammany, high protection crowd. It's a real king, not a possible one like TR." It's not one man. It's a tight combine of men. It's not impulsive, generous, full of human faults, but always for the human right. The priority, implored Tarbell, must be to destroy this very able alliance that got us all in its grip. That must be made clear. Then, if TR needs to be batted a bit, we can do it. The American magazine never ran a specific piece to counter criticism of King Roosevelt, but John Phillips, Albert Boyden, John Sidall, and John Finley Dunn all finally supported Roosevelt and the Progressive Party. Another of McClure's old team, Lincoln Steffens, was less well disposed toward Theodore Roosevelt when the campaign season opened. Months earlier, the two men had crossed swords over the sensational trial of Union leaders John and James McNamara, who had been accused of setting off a bomb at the Los Angeles Times building. The blast, directed at anti-Union newspaper publisher Harrison Gray Otis, killed 21 working men and injured 100 others. Labor leaders across the country rose to the defense of the two Union men. Likewise, Steffens publicly defended the brothers, labeling the bombing an act of social revolution rather than a crime. Roosevelt was disgusted by such a justification. "It seems to me that Steffens made an utter fool of himself," he told a California friend. "Murder is murder," he proclaimed in an Outlook editorial, "and the foolish sentimentalists or sinister wrongdoers who try to apologize for it as an incident of labor warfare are not only morally culpable, but are enemies of the American people, and above all, are enemies of American wage workers." But even fierce disagreement with Roosevelt over the culpability of the McNamara brothers did not prevent Steffens from sympathizing with both the Progressive Party and the Colonel's continuing struggle against the titans of Wall Street. "It looks like Wilson out here," the journalist reported to his brother-in-law after canvassing a wide range of opinion. "All the interests are determined to beat TR, at any rate. They have given up Taft, and they don't care for Wilson, but the man they hate is the Bull Moose, and they are bound to beat him if they can. It's personal, you see." Early on, Taft made it clear that he had no plans to engage in a whirlwind campaign. Though he planned to deliver a few prepared speeches in Washington or Beverly, he would observe the time-honored precedent that a president who is a candidate for re-election should remain at home and leave it to the judgment of the people to decide whether or not his record of achievement deserved a second term. He believed in his heart that he had executed his office with dignity and fairness, endeavoring in a judicial manner to decide all issues on their merits without regard to personal advantage. He had revitalized an aging Supreme Court by appointing a staggering 6 justices to the bench, all distinguished lawyers, half of them Democrats. More importantly, Taft's countrymen had enjoyed 4 years of peace and prosperity under his administration. While the federal government could not bid the rain to fall, the sun to shine, or the crops to grow, Taft remarked, it could, by pursuing wrong-headed policies, halt enterprise, paralyze investment, or cause hundreds of thousands of working men to lose their jobs. William Taft trusted that the negative virtue of having taken no step to interfere with the coming of prosperity and the comfort of the people is one that ought highly to commend an administration and the party responsible for it as worthy of further continuance of power. Taft's campaign managers accepted his refusal to go on the stump, but worried that both Roosevelt and Wilson would dominate headlines while Taft seemed detached from the battle. Without active leadership from the White House, RNC Chairman Charles Hillis found it difficult to raise funds, engage surrogate speakers, or keep the public's attention on the president. "It always makes me impatient," Taft confided to Nellie, "as if I were running a P.T. Barnum show, with 2 or 3 shows across the street, as if I ought to have as much advertising as the rest." When advisers suggested that he replicate the aggressive demeanor of the Bull Moose, he circuitously declared, "I couldn't if I would, and I wouldn't if I could." Clearly the campaign had savagely exacerbated existing tensions between Taft and Theodore Roosevelt. "As the campaign goes on," Taft told Nellie, "it is hard for me to realize that we are talking about the same man as that man whom we knew in the presidency. As far as his personal relations with his erstwhile friend, Taft bluntly added, "They don't exist." Seriously hurt by the rift, Taft preferred to recall his old friend and mentor as almost a separate person than the belligerent, insult-hurling foe against whom he currently contended. He now looked upon Roosevelt simply as an historical character of a most peculiar type, in whom are embodied elements of real greatness, together with certain traits that have now shown themselves in unfitting him for any trust or confidence. Taft was particularly incensed by the open contempt Roosevelt displayed both toward him personally and for the nation's highest office. When an audience member solicited comment on the president, Roosevelt mockingly replied, "I never discuss dead issues." Before another audience, the colonel repeated a variation of his jest, observing that all the old Republican bosses were shifting allegiance to Wilson, recognizing that the president was a dead cock in the pit. Nor, Roosevelt elaborated, was the Republican platform even worthy of serious discussion, given that it was adopted at a convention organized by theft. The fall campaign was already in full swing before the president yielded to his supporters' pleas. Standing before an audience of 2,500 cheering Republicans on the lawn of his summer home in Beverly, he delivered a spirited attack on Roosevelt's third party. One issue stood above all others, he declared, eclipsing the traditional partisan wrangling between Republicans and Democrats over the tariff and the trusts. The issue of the preservation of the institutions of civil liberty as they were handed down to us by our forefathers. Splitting away from the Republican Party, a third party had been created merely to gratify personal ambition and vengeance. In the pursuit of votes, this new party had employed every new fad and theory, some of them good, some of them utterly preposterous and impracticable, some of them as socialistic as anything that has been proposed in the countries of Europe. All had been stuffed into the progressive platform. Taken together, the president warned, these reforms suggested an entire willingness to destroy every limitation of constitutional representative government. So long as Republicans remained true to their heritage, he predicted, this radical movement would surely fail. The great bulk of our people are not emotional, undiscriminating, superficially minded, non-thinking, or hero-worshipping, he asserted. They have the virtue of second sober thought. Expanding on the same theme 2 days later at the Beverly Republican Club, Taft predicted that the secession of the third party would prompt a new vitality among traditional Republicans. "We know that we are a better set of men than we are now called by those who were very glad at one time to be known as leading Republicans. No student of history can deny that the grandeur of this nation and the height that it has reached among the nations during the last 60 years has been due to the guidance and the force, and the energy, and the enterprise of the Republican Party." Well aware from the outset that the Republican split made victory in November very improbable, Roosevelt nevertheless resolved to give every ounce of his energy to the campaign. He embarked upon an unprecedented speaking tour, covering 40 states and every region of the country, including the solid Democratic South. He planned to travel by train, making whistle stops at hundreds of small towns along the way. Although he anticipated a deluge of travel and dust and howling and irritated fatigue, he would willingly invest a tremendous amount of very hard work so long as there was a chance of victory. In addition to 3 or 4 prepared addresses each day, he agreed to appear on the train's rear platform wherever a crowd assembled, to ride in parades, attend banquets, and meet with local committeemen. "I'm perfectly happy," he told his British friend, Arthur Hamilton Lee, "for I have never in my life been in a movement into which I could enter as heartily as into this." The colonel opened his campaign in Providence, Rhode Island. Journalists noted with amazement that even in this boss-ridden and rock-ribbed Republican state, immense crowds welcomed him. The 7,000 cheering people who thronged the streets, mostly workers from the textile mills and nearby shops, were markedly different from the usual Republican gatherings. Speaking that evening to an overflow audience at Infantry Hall, Roosevelt decried the rule of the bosses, beseeching his listeners to help establish the rule of the people in its place. Echoing the crusading spirit of the Progressive Convention, the audience launched into the battle hymn of the Republic and onward Christian soldiers. A massive banner above the speaker's rostrum bore the legend, "We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord." Buoyed by his enthusiastic reception, Roosevelt predicted that progressives could triumph anywhere if they could get the people to realize what they were trying to accomplish. Governor Wilson had initially hoped to confine his campaign appearances to a few well-prepared speeches. "My private judgment," he told a Washington Times correspondent, "is that extended stumping tours are not the most effective method of conducting a campaign. You must remember that I am governor of New Jersey, and that I must keep in touch with the business of the state." He hoped to reach the public through a reasoned discussion of the issues and a clear explication of his political philosophy. He had no appetite for the kind of whistle-stop tour that would require him to stand on a train platform and shout extemporaneous remarks to a boisterous crowd. Convinced from the beginning that Taft would run third, Woodrow Wilson viewed Roosevelt as his chief adversary. "I am by no means confident," he admitted to a friend. "He appeals to their imagination. I do not. He is a real, vivid person, whom they have seen and shouted themselves hoarse over and voted for, millions strong. I am a vague, conjectural personality, more made-up opinions and academic prepossessions than of human traits and red corpuscles." The colonel's headlong campaign would demand sustained exertion. "I haven't a bull moose's strength," Wilson reflected, "as Roosevelt seems to have." Despite his reservations, Wilson eventually agreed to make an extensive tour of the Midwest during the month of September, followed by a second trip as far west as Colorado in October. The governor had, in reality, only one speech to make, Baker observed, and he made it again and again. He urged listeners to envision a more expansive future for themselves and their country. He delivered his words with such consummate skill as an orator that each audience came away convinced that Wilson had spoken directly to their hopes and needs. Wilson was a new personality in American public life, Ray Baker explained. He profited by antithesis. He had the unfamiliar glamour, to the popular eye, of the scholar, the thinker, the historian. There had been enough heat in politics. What was needed now was light. Wilson was expository rather than denunciatory. He was asking the country to look at its problems. He was not offering panaceas. With disarming honesty, the candidate repeatedly stated, "I do not want to promise heaven unless I can bring it to you. I can only see a little distance up the road." Positive responses from both audiences and the traveling press corps bolstered the governor's confidence. Speaking at Boston's Tremont Temple on September 27th, he relaxed enough to offer a playful barb at Roosevelt's expense. "Suppose you choose the leader of the third party as president. Don't you think he will be pretty lonely? Not that he'll mind it, because I believe he finds himself rather good company." Wilson's lighthearted ribbing of Roosevelt's majestic ego underscored a serious point. Without a majority party behind him in Congress, the colonel would likely find it difficult to get anything done. Retiring to the Copley Plaza following his speech, Wilson discovered that President Taft was in the banquet hall for a dinner address to the International Congress of Chambers of Commerce. The governor sent word that he would be very glad of the opportunity to meet with the president before the evening ended. Shortly before midnight, a meeting was arranged in a private suite on the fifth floor. "I hope the campaigning has not worn you out," Taft remarked. "It has been quite a hard week," the governor acknowledged. Indeed, his voice had gotten a bit husky from overuse. "Well," Taft cordially responded, "there are three men that can sympathize with you. Mr. Bryant, Mr. Roosevelt, and myself." The mutual regard between Taft and Wilson was evident as the conversation continued. "It was a very delightful meeting," Wilson told reporters waiting in the corridor. "I am very fond of President Taft." The natural warmth President Taft showed to Governor Wilson reflected an odd tranquility about the election. While he occasionally detected currents of air that seemed to be blowing in the right direction, he acknowledged to friends that he would probably be defeated. Winning the nomination had been the all-important victory, and not simply because he had bested Roosevelt. He had long believed that a loss at the convention would have been regarded as a personal rejection, whereas defeat in the fall election reflected a more general reverse for the party. "I seem to think that we have won what there was to fight about, and that what follows is less important," he told Nellie, without a trace of defensive rationalization. Nellie shared her husband's equanimity. "I wanted him to be re-elected, naturally," she later wrote, "but I never entertained the slightest expectation of it, and only longed for the end of the turmoil, when he could rest his weary mind and get back into association with the pleasant things of life." In the aftermath of Nellie's stroke, her close family circle had sustained her. Her children were thriving. Robert was an editor of the Harvard Law Review. Helen would soon be returning to Bryn Mawr, and irrepressible Charlie was getting excellent grades at the Taft School in Connecticut, where Horace kept a watchful eye over him. As the election approached, Nellie remained in Beverly, content to be removed from the political fray. "She is in a condition where defeat will not disappoint her, if at all," Taft reported to Horace. "I am glad to say she is in a happy frame of mind." As the Bull Moose candidate headed west through Iowa and North Dakota to Oregon and California, he continued to attract huge crowds. Nonetheless, his managers fretted that he was going stale, repeating tired arguments about the Republican convention, the collusion of business and politics, and the dangers of vesting too much power in the courts. Instead of rehashing these matters, they pressed him to engage Woodrow Wilson directly. To prepare for such a confrontation, Roosevelt commenced to study the governor's record, receiving daily briefings on his speeches and closely following his rival's campaign. A select group at Roosevelt's headquarters prepared a lengthy report that outlined Wilson's position on every question, from the minimum wage and woman suffrage to labor and the trusts. "From that point forward," remarked Roosevelt's publicity chief, Oscar King Davis, "it was Wilson, Wilson, Wilson all the time in the private car, and nothing but Wilson and his record in the colonel's talks." Roosevelt launched the first direct assault on his Democratic opponent in San Francisco with what the New York Times deemed the most important speech of his campaign since his confession of faith. His criticism addressed the fundamental role of the government in a democratic society. "Mr. Wilson is fond of asserting his platonic devotion to the purposes of the Progressive Party," Roosevelt began, "but such platonic devotion is utterly worthless from a political standpoint, because he antagonizes the only means by which those purposes can be made effective." Roosevelt claimed that the key to Mr. Wilson's position could be found in a single line he had recently voiced in New York. "The history of liberty," Wilson had stated, "is the history of the limitation of governmental power, not the increase of it." Such an understanding, Roosevelt charged, was a reincarnation of the old laissez-faire doctrine, which, if restored, would mean the undoing of every particle of social and industrial advance we have made. Under Wilson's theory of limited governmental power, Roosevelt charged, every railroad must be left unchecked, every great industrial concern can do as it chooses with its employees and with the general public, women must be permitted to work as many hours a day as their taskmasters bid them. By contrast, his own party would build on laws recently established to protect the